It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, our guests make the case for increasing funding for fundamental scientific research they say could pay off in terms of better treatment for many kinds of cancer.
Right now, we're continuing our series of candidate forums in the race for governor of Wisconsin.
While the race is mainly being framed as a close battle between Governor Walker and Democratic challenger Mary Burke, there are two third-party candidates on the ballot looking to shake things up.
We just heard from People's Party candidate Dennis Fear. Now we're turning to Robert Burke. He's the founder of the Libertarian Party of Pierce and St. Croix Counties and is the Libertarian candidate for governor. He joins us today from our studio in Eau Claire. Robert, thanks so much for joining us.
Veronica and Rob, thank you very much for having me on. These radio opportunities are a great chance for people to hear about what we stand for and our ideas, and so we really appreciate the chance.
Well, Robert, we'll start out with our traditional first question here. Why are you running for governor?
I bring the most pragmatic understanding of the economics of not only our state but the country. I worked for 13 years as a financial services wholesaler. I've sat down with financial planners and with analysts and with small business owners, and I have a very good understanding of how wealth and success are built. But within that experience, I came across information and an understanding of the big problems within our economy and within our system. And I looked around at the red team, and I actually sat on the red team's, that's the Republican Party. I don't call them Republican and Democrat. Those two words mean something completely different than what those two parties stand for. I call them the red team and the blue team. I sat on the red team's platform committee in 2012. And I tried to enter language into our platform that said, look, Social Security is in severe distress and there are significant problems. And we need to include in our platform that this needs to be addressed because they're not doing anything at the national level. And the room went literally almost apoplectic over the idea that we would ever write that into a platform because, of course, we would lose the elections. And I wanted to know, at what point do we start telling the public the truth? When do we actually look the public in the eye and say, hey, you know what? The red team along with the blue team, yeah, we stole your Social Security. There's a lockbox and it's actually sitting in Washington, D.C. in an office, and it's a little filing cabinet that's got pieces of paper that say Social Security Treasury Bonds, Special Social Security Treasury Bonds. They took your money and they moved it into the general budget, and then they spent it. And the only way they get the money back to pay for Social Security is either to print the money from the Federal Reserve or to borrow the money more from other governments and other agencies and investors. And neither of these are solutions that we should have to go to. We should have trillions of dollars sitting in reserves for Social Security, but they stole it. And since they weren't willing to tell the truth, I decided it was time to leave the parties and to figure out who was telling the truth. And it turns out the Libertarians were.
Well, Robert, if you could tell us a little bit about your background and how that prepares you to take the state's highest office.
Well, one of the things that occurred to me and happened was in 2009, a good friend of mine was laid off. And when he was laid off, I stopped and I asked myself, we had this crash happen in our markets and I was working in the financial services. And I thought, I should know what's going on. And how did I miss this? So I started doing my own homework. This is the one thing I bring to this campaign that I think is above and beyond what either Mary Burke or Scott Walker or even Dennis Fair bring to the table. And that is that I actually sat down and did my homework on what the problems are. Dennis and I have talked a number of times about the problem with the Federal Reserve, but it goes deeper than that. I looked into how we actually tax individuals and what the nature of taxation is. I looked at how regulation actually keeps the small guy out. I looked into what education opportunities would actually benefit society and bring us to that next level of quality education. We have great education in the state of Wisconsin. I think we can still do better. So I did a lot of my own homework. When Mary Burke gets accused of plagiarizing because a consultant wrote her reports, look, I don't have a problem with her buying her jobs plan. She's an executive. That's what they do. They don't usually write most of their material. They give basic outlines and some ideas, and somebody else does the work. It just turns out the person who usually does the work was me. And so I bring that street-level understanding of how things actually operate in these complex systems. And I understand how to improve them for the actual people of Wisconsin, who are, great people, but primarily middle and lower end of the economic scale. And we need to do something radical to begin helping them build the wealth that they should have, frankly, in our economic system.
And just to be clear, despite sharing the same last name, you have no affiliation with Mary Burke, correct?
She's my mom. No, I'm kidding. No, Mary Burke's not related to me whatsoever.
As a libertarian, it seems safe to say that you're in support of less government. What areas of the state government do you think could benefit from being reduced?
Well, the first thing I would do is I would get rid of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. We should not be giving private taxpayer dollars to private companies. If these companies decide that they want to open their companies up in Wisconsin, they should do it because we give them an environment that's positive for them to do so, but not because we give them money. We keep giving away these tax credits and eliminating the property tax bills for these companies to open up here in Wisconsin. Look, if it's good for a brand new business to not pay property taxes, it should be good for our existing businesses to not pay property taxes. In fact, it should be good for everybody to not pay property taxes, and that's one of the platforms that I stand on. One of the reasons we have a real problem with the poor in our state is that as long as we have a property tax system, we're always just renting our home. We need to create a system where we encourage the poor to buy a home, pay off the home, and create a stable lifestyle. That's the first thing you do to help the poor. But every year when you wake up and you owe $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, not only that, but an ever-increasing tax bill, that doesn't help the poor. And so I would get rid of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. That's a really big part we can start with. I would do radical reductions, if not a full elimination, of the Department of Workforce Development. You can't take money out of the economy of Wisconsin, send it to Madison so that all the efficiencies of government can be applied to it, and then ship those dollars back out into the state and think that, you know, 85, 90 cents on the dollar is as good as leaving 100 cents in the economy to begin with. That's how you create jobs. You create them by not taking the dollars out of the economy to begin with.
Do you believe it is the government's responsibility to create jobs as a libertarian?
No, the government doesn't create jobs. The government either creates the environment to create jobs or it hinders the environment to create jobs. And it does so two ways. You know, when you have a product that's created, any product anywhere in America or in the world has three input costs. You have the labor input cost, and Wisconsin has great labor. We have a very educated population, and we need to work to continue that. We have natural resources, or the actual hard resources that go into every product. And we have great natural resources in the state, but we have problems. And we'll talk. We can talk about hemp in particular and saving our paper plants if you'd like. But that third input is the government input, and that's our regulatory process, and that is our tax structure. And if we radically reform these, jobs will flock to Wisconsin, and that's what we really need to look at doing.
And there's been a lot of talk over whether or not the state should raise the minimum wage. Would you raise it, keep it the same, or would you eliminate the minimum wage altogether?
In 1964, the minimum wage was $1.25. Now, that $1.25 was actually made of 90% silver. Those were quarters that were 90% silver. Today, the value of those five quarters is about $17. This is what we've done to the purchasing power, as Dennis mentioned earlier. This is what we've done to the purchasing power of our money. And this is what is not only destroying our poor, but it's eroding, deeply eroding at our middle class. And he was right. The Federal Reserve is a significant problem. And while that's a national issue that has to be dealt with, we need to have somebody high enough in government that's talking to our congressional delegation and saying, you guys need to audit the Fed. You need to not only audit the Fed, but once you see what they're doing, you'll get rid of the Fed the next day. I promise you that you'll do that, because they're destroying our wealth. And every time we print money for things like the Affordable Care Act, when we print that money to send money to the states for their exchanges, all we're really doing is sucking pennies out of everybody's pocket and then redistributing it to our healthcare industry. We spend more on healthcare in this state than anywhere else in the nation or in the world. And that isn't to say that we shouldn't have a strong healthcare system. But we don't have an efficient healthcare system. We have a very expensive one, and it's all part of a problem that we have to face. So if government isn't helping to solve these problems, it's actually causing these problems.
And let's see if we can get in one call here before the news. Matt joins us first in Sparta. Hi, Matt.
Hi there. First of all, kudos to Mr. Berg for having the bravery to stand up to both parties and try to make them admit that they straight up stole Social Security. I mean, there's no question about that. So that's awesome. Kudos to him for that. Also, I want to know how he feels about abolishing income tax altogether, state and federal, and replacing it with a straight sales tax. And of course, he would probably have to increase the sales tax to equal the amount of money that is coming in currently, but that way people are not taxed on what they earn and they are only taxed on what they buy. I'm just curious how he feels about that.
That's a great question. So let me have a paradigm change here for folks that are listening in. All the taxes that people think are being paid by the wealthy are actually being paid by you at the register. If I can change one paradigm in one conversation about taxation in our state, it's that when you walk up to the register, and I like to, this is what I call my Lucky Charms example. When you walk up to the register and buy a box of Lucky Charms, the property tax and the income tax of the farmer is built into that box. And in fact, the property taxes and the income tax of every single person who works in the mill, the ground, the flour, are built into that box. In fact, everybody who works at General Mills, including the CEO of General Mills, who in 2012 made $13 million, his $6.5 million in taxes, that's built into that box of Lucky Charms. You're taxing yourself. So by moving to a sales tax model, what you would do is you would allow yourself the ability to not tax the poor at all. So what I would propose is a two-tiered sales tax system. And this is in some ways built on Maslow's hierarchy. And what I would do is I would tax food, energy, shelter, and clothing at a single low level. And then for our poor, what they would do is we would actually rebate back 100% of their tax dollars to the poverty, and then we would actually graduate it out from poverty to 33% over poverty so that our poor actually aren't paying taxes. But if you go to a doctor today, and let's say the doctor costs $300 to see, $150 of what you pay to see the doctor goes to pay those income taxes. He didn't pay the income taxes. You paid the income taxes. So we have to change how we look at our tax structure and our tax system. I actually want to stop taxing the poor. We tax the poor at the highest level because every product they buy has all of those taxes built into it. And in fact, on Saturday, the 25th, from 8 to 11, I'm going to be in Milwaukee at a community brainstorming conference. We're going to talk about how we help to improve the problems in their black neighborhoods and across the entire city. And one of the things that we have to understand is that they have 1 in 8 black men in Milwaukee currently incarcerated. And part of the problem with that is they can't get competent legal help. Because when they go and sit down with a doctor or with a lawyer and the lawyer costs $500, $250 of seeing that lawyer is just taxes. I want to get rid of those taxes so they can get a lawyer for $250 that is competent. So we have to look at this tax structure and what it actually does to our poor. It doesn't act like people think it does. I want to simplify it. I'll need a fraction of the size for the Department of Revenue in order to administer and to police it. And that's a good thing for not only cost, but for our poor.
We're talking right now with Robert Burke. He's a Libertarian candidate for governor, and you can join in. If you've got a question for Robert or you're wondering where he stands on an issue, you can give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Today and tomorrow on the show, we're talking with the candidates running for governor here in Wisconsin. And we've got Robert Burke with us right now. He's the Libertarian candidate for governor.
And if you've got a question for him, you can join in right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can raise an issue that and see what he has to say about it. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org.
We turn to our phone lines now and take a call from Nicholas in Mount Horeb. Hi, Nicholas.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to ask Mr. Burke, if it was the Burke administration that came to power 4 years ago, would he mind speculating on two or three issues that he would have taken on and perhaps done differently than Governor Walker has?
Gotcha, Nicholas.
And I'll take my question off the air.
All right, thanks, Nicholas. And Robert, what do you say?
Well, thank you, Nicholas, for the question. You know, let's talk about something that's not being talked at all in this election. And if I had been in the invited to participate in the debates, the televised debates, I would have made sure that we brought this up. I would have turned some corner on this. We need to do a couple of big things. One thing we need to do is we need to nullify the federal ban on growing hemp within our state. We have paper mills that are shutting down. For example, the paper mill in Brokaw, Wisconsin, shut down. 450 jobs were lost, and they have a $4.5 million budget hole in their budget for the city of Brokaw, the village of Brokaw. We need to grow hemp in this state. We used to grow. We were one of the last states to give it up. And we actually have one of the best environments for growing hemp around the nation. And what that would allow us to do is not just to reinvigorate and build our paper plant industry back up, but one of the other things that we can do is it can be used for biofuels. It can be used for food stuff. It can be used for textiles. You can make clothing out of it. This would have, you know, if Governor Walker wants to know where the other 150,000 jobs he promised are, they're right there in hemp. A good fraction of those are in that bill. And the state legislature took it up and failed to actually accomplish anything with that. And that's a failure of leadership from the administration. The second thing I would have done is I would have legalized marijuana. We need to get this done and we need to do it tomorrow. If we're the 50th state, we miss all the opportunity for the innovations that come from this. But there's a more important part to this. We've had a number of large grows that have been busted in the state. Now, I worked as a nursing assistant for 3 years. I worked in a nursing home. I worked in home health care. I worked in inpatient physical rehab. And I will tell you that there are brand new studies out that show that marijuana not only can help with Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis, cancer, a whole host of things from a medical side. We need to do this, and we need to do it yesterday. Again, it's a failure of leadership from the administration that they not only won't even consider it, but they don't even consider that this is causing additional problems socially for our society.
And Robert, let me just jump in here. If we look at something beyond marijuana and hemp, is there a third or a different category you want to point to?
Yeah, you know, another category of things that I probably would have changed and taken in a different direction would have been addressing the the tax system, obviously, is the big one for me. My 4-point plan is to change the sales tax, the income tax, legalize hemp is a big part of that as well. Those would have been the big ones that I would have tackled in the first 4 years.
Great. Well, thank you for that call. And looking to education now, do you envision making any significant changes to the state's education budget? And would you support an expansion of charter and voucher schools here in Wisconsin?
This wouldn't happen overnight because the system isn't ready for this level of action. But yeah, libertarians support a fully vouchered education system. And I'll explain why really simply. You know, when I was in high school, I was a D-plus student. I think I finished maybe 320th out of 380 kids in my school. I don't learn on a slow rotational basis of a classroom every 50 minutes. I actually learn in an environment where I can take an issue and then dig deep that I'm really interested in. And when I went to college, when I was 21 years old, when I went to college, I actually graduated with a 4.0 in my major and a 3.5 overall. And it isn't that the public education system isn't serving and isn't doing a marvelous job for many, many students. But you know, there's an old joke that says 50% of all doctors graduate in the bottom of their class. Well, that doesn't mean that they all don't graduate with A's or B's. But in our public education, there is a level of individuals, probably that bottom 20%, who are just not serviced by our education model. And we're not allowing them an opportunity to succeed by denying them an opportunity to seek outside the system education opportunities. This education model was designed, by the way, around the turn of the 18th century during the Industrial Revolution. It was to get kids used to going from station to station like you do in a factory. We're already past the technology revolution. We're into the information revolution. And if we stick to the idea that you have to sit in a classroom 7 hours a day for 50-minute classes, we're missing the opportunity to take advantage of an entire new paradigm in education. And that's what we should be striving for in Wisconsin, to lead the country in what education can be for everyone, which is an opportunity to succeed.
Now, looking at the environment next, you come from the western part of the state where fracks and mining is becoming a booming industry. It's not, of course, without controversy. As governor, would you seek additional regulations on the industry?
No, actually, I would seek a different paradigm in how we deal with the issue. We spend so much of our taxpayer dollars with lawyers and DNR going in and setting standards. Now, the problem with the DNR is you set a standard for water quality, and then they pollute up to that water quality standard, and the average consumer has no or a property owner can't do anything about it because they had permission to pollute that much. What a libertarian would do is change the laws, and we would do what's called pierce the corporate veil. Look, if you want to dig a frack sand mine, knock yourself out and dig a frack sand mine. But if you pollute the property, you pollute the wetlands, you pollute the rivers in our state, I'm going to find the owners of these frack sand mines. I'm going to go after their personal wealth. If they're negligent, I'm going to put them in jail. But you can go online right now, and you can go frack sand mine fines, and what you're going to find is over and over and over and over and over, we find the mining companies. And the mining companies will amortize those costs out over a number of years, and they'll pass it on to the consumer. You're paying these fines that these companies get for polluting. I want to go after the people who are actually polluting. I promise you, you break the bank of one of these wealthy individuals who owns these mines, just one, the rest of them will clean it up. They won't bother to pollute our lands, and they'll question whether or not they want to dig mines that could pollute our waterways. And that's the way it should be, is protection of property. And we do that by finding individuals and holding individuals accountable.
Now, Robert, if you were elected governor, you'd be working with a legislature primarily made up of Republicans and Democrats, or Team Red and Team Blue, as you call them. How do you envision working with both parties to ensure that things get done?
You know, libertarians are in a lot of ways that great middle ground. We bring a socially liberal ideology. We believe in civil unions. We need to get out of the idea of calling it marriage, and not because marriage has a bad thing for it, but people have a lot of very strong feelings about this word in a religious context. So let's take the word marriage out. Let's stop having a semantics argument. Send it back to the churches. If you want to get married, go visit a church. And let's call it civil unions. Let's make it about protecting property rights. If two men want to buy a home, let's make make sure that the home ownership can transfer upon death. If one gets in an accident and they want to make their gay partner their decision maker for their health care needs, these are property issues. And I think that I bring a paradigm, and libertarians bring a paradigm, that we can work on a number of social issues with the legislature to reframe these problems and actually start solving them. Because look at how long it took us to get through gay marriage. This is, we spend way too much time, way too much money on some simple issues. At the same time, we're fiscally conservative. We are going to balance the budget. We are not going to continue to go deeper and deeper in debt. And we're going to do that by reducing the number of things that get money from the government, in particular, private companies that shouldn't be getting private taxpayer dollars.
Robert, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. And I hope I see some folks like my Facebook page. That's my primary tool. Happy to take any questions there. Robert Burke for Governor, Libertarian.
Robert Burke is the Libertarian candidate for Governor. Earlier in the program, we heard from the People's Party candidate, Dennis Fehr. And tomorrow at 3:30, Democratic challenger Mary Burke joins us for a candidate forum. We extended an invitation to Governor Walker, but he was unable to join us.
The case for basic science research. It may not be heavily branded or supported always by big money, but our guests now say basic science research, the kind that's necessary for things like more targeted medical advances, is getting harder to fund. And without it, we might be missing out on big breakthroughs, treatments, cures, and diagnostic tools.
Rebecca Ryan wrote about the need for basic science research in Madison Magazine. She's an economist, author, and futurist, and she's the owner and founder of Next Generation Consulting. She joins us now.
Also with us is Caroline Alexander. She's a professor in the McArdle Laboratory for Cancer Research. That's the Cancer Discovery Wing affiliated with the UW-Carbone Cancer Center. Rebecca, welcome to the show.
Great to be back. How are you?
Good. And Caroline, thanks for joining us up here in the studio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Rebecca, let's start with you. What do we mean when we talk about research on basic science?
Yeah, so, well, I learned this from Caroline, actually. When you think about cancer research as an example, there's the basic research, and this is the research that, you know, could pursue nearly any end. And it basic research is fundamental to the kind of research that leads to discovery drugs because, or new methodologies. So basic research is done by PhDs like Caroline. They come up with these interesting findings, and based on those interesting findings, we get to do clinical trials. So without basic research, we don't ever come up with things for clinical trials. So it's really the fundamental layer at the bottom of the research pyramid.
And Caroline, you use a different phrase, as I understand it, discovery research. Why is that?
Right, because I think basic research sounds a little dull and as if it is 101 basic research, and we might be a little bit slow off the mark. But I actually think that it is the basis for every other discovery. You have to know how the processes work. And it can sound very eclectic, and you may well be working on red-striped Drosophila fly bottoms, but, you know, there is going to be some genetics behind that that might be telling for some cancer discovery in the future.
And Rebecca, is part of the solution, and we'll get into the funding issue in a minute, but do you think this idea of rebranding it, just kind of talking about it in a different way, something like discovery research instead of basic science, is that something that's going to make a difference, make it a little sexier for funders?
Yeah, I really do think so. I mean, the way that I got interested in reporting this story is because I met Caroline through some mutual friends, and I just said, you know, what are you working on? And she said, oh, you know, the funding for the kind of research I do, and she described it as basic, and I said, oh my gosh, Caroline, like, that is a huge branding problem. That is not sexy. Like, we need a sexier term for this. And it got me interested in the whole story and what's at stake for Wisconsin.
And Caroline, why is basic science discovery research, do you think, not getting enough funding?
I think there was an initiative that came from the National Cancer Institute that research should be more translational. And that suggested to everybody that they should be translational. In other words, they should be taking drugs into the clinic, which is an enormously expensive process. And frankly, we're not ready. We're not ready with all these new ideas to translate them to the clinic. It's always a stage-wise process. And we've got lots more leads ready to go. As you know, cancer treatments are not perfect. So we have a lot more work to do to find out what is perfect.
Well, Caroline, let's look back in the past a little bit. What has been the payoff in terms of cancer treatments from basic science over the decades, maybe even the last century?
I think it's all come from basic. It's a question of how, it's a question of timeline. So perhaps for any given drugs, so for example, our department, the McArdle, Charlie Heidelberger was the originator of the most widely used cancer drug. If anybody knows any cancer treatments, they've probably been administered something called 5-FU. And he was the originator of this drug, and he was looking at how to inhibit cell growth. And that's a very basic process in the test tube, and that basically the first 10 years of its life, any given lead might spend in a little test tube in somewhere in a back office in a basic research lab before it begins to be translated towards the clinic. So most of its lifetime, it'll be at the bench.
And Rebecca, do you think part of the funding problem, the reason that people aren't latching onto this, is because the time scale is longer? People think, hey, let's start where we are and get a cancer drug that might be on the market in 3 years instead of fundamental research that might open up a lot of doors in 10 or 20 years.
I think that is one of the issues, Rob. I mean, absolutely. You know, our attention spans get shorter and shorter. When you think about who approves these budgets, these people are trying to get reelected, and they want to be able to show results, right? And things that they funded brought results. So we do tend to take less of a long-term approach to this. But, you know, I also think the other thing that's happened is when you look at the number of science writers who, you know, write for major, you know, daily or weekly or even monthly publications, it's gone down and down and down. And so I think I speak for myself as a layperson. I don't have a high science IQ. I don't know many people who do. When Carolyn and I sat down together, you know, I was like, wait, you got to like break this down for me. I don't even really understand everything that you're talking about. And because we as American citizens don't have a high science IQ, we don't even understand that basic research precedes translational research. So it's hard for us to prioritize it or ask our, you know, elected representatives to prioritize it. So I think it's a series of issues.
And Caroline, you're a cancer researcher. I would like to think that you spend most of your time in a day researching cancer. How much of your time ends up being devoted to raising funds to enable the research you do?
At the moment, all of it. Pretty
really?
Much, almost all of it. It's. I think the average person might be putting in a grant every month at the moment, and one of these grants might take you 6 weeks to prepare. So if you do the math, you're spending nights as well. So, well,
and if you're doing it, sorry, Rebecca, just a moment. But if you're doing it in terms of I'm applying for a grant for a year, you know, here, and then maybe I get it this year and not the next year. How does that affect the research? Is this the kind of thing where you need to be doing this for 5, 10 years at a stretch and know you're going to be doing it to really make sense of what you're looking at?
Right. So the big federal grants tend to be 5 years long, which is a good time to hire somebody and train them or for a graduate student to develop a thesis. So these are long-term projects. You can't hurry science. It's like love.
And Rebecca, sorry, jump in.
No. Well, what I just wanted to say was, you know, that was the other piece, what you just mentioned about, for example, Caroline's use of her time. Caroline, well, you know, won't talk about this. She's a brilliant researcher. Everyone I met at McArdle is working on amazing breakthrough science, and it just sort of killed me as an economist to see how much of their time was spent writing grants and in front of their computer instead of coming up with the next, you know, possible theory that should be chased. I mean, I feel like it's a huge waste of human training and potential to have these brilliant researchers just filling out these mind-numbing grant requests instead of focusing on where their highest, best use and training is.
Well, I wonder if another stumbling block is the idea that many of these discovery research projects, basic science research projects, will ultimately go nowhere. It's kind of like investigative journalism. Sometimes you put the time in and there's nothing there. Is that, do you think, Caroline, a stumbling block for, say, politicians or philanthropists who want to fund this?
Yeah, it's true. It doesn't go nowhere, but it might not show up in the clinic. That's correct. It's kind of building on the shoulders of giants. So it's a slow process of accruing knowledge. So yeah, they take a risk.
And you are trying some innovative ways to communicate with even smaller, lower levels of philanthropy to say, hey, here's the difference your funding is making. How are you doing that?
Well, I actually think it goes deeper than that because I think perhaps talking to Rebecca's point that it's really important to help people understand what we're doing. I think there's so much suspicion about scientists. And so it's kind of one of my ambitions to have the McArdle Laboratory for Cancer Research be on the tip of the tongue for Wisconsin people, because it's a fantastic institution. I wonder if they know how amazing it is. 75 years of really consistent productivity. I have to say, I heard of it first in a little college in Canterbury in England, and my mentor at the time was on sabbatical in Madison, and the excitement that came back to Canterbury was what convinced me to come here. So that your reputation goes far and wide, and I wonder if people in Wisconsin know what they have here.
Rebecca Caroline mentions the reputation this kind of thing could bring to Wisconsin. You also touched on the possible economic benefits of putting money into basic science here in the state.
Yeah, and this is, you know, when we talk about the future of research, you know, we often talk about how it's going to impact you or me or someone we love who is diagnosed with cancer. But we also should think about our sons and daughters and their economic future. And, you know, one of the things I think we can be really proud of is that, you know, the spinoffs from McArdle. So we have in the Madison area, we have ProMega. We've got a cluster in Wausau. We've got spinoffs that have come directly out of McArdle. We have a whole sector now in this state of people who are paid very, very well in biomedical careers, and that came from the 75-year investment in McArdle. So this is about curing cancer, absolutely, but this is also about the economy of the state and really good paying jobs and being in a knowledge-based economy. And that's, I think, exciting for my kids and grandkids and, you know, everybody we care about for generations to come.
And Caroline, before we wrap up, you talked about some of the discoveries over the years from McArdle. I know in Rebecca's piece you mentioned frustration that some treatments haven't changed in a long time. Where do you see the potential for the next big development in cancer treatment coming from the kind of discovery research you're talking about?
Well, we would hope that we would be able to, I mean, breast cancer treatment is not the way to go. It should be prevention. So we can't afford to have 1 in 8 women developing breast cancer over a lifetime. That's an impossible mental burden. It's an impossible financial burden. So it's really about understanding the disease and prevention. To me, I think that's the big hurdle that we have to overcome.
Leave it there for now. Caroline, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Rebecca, thanks to you as well.
My pleasure.
That was Rebecca Ryan, founder and owner of Next Generation Consulting, and Caroline Alexander, professor in the McArdle Laboratory for Cancer Research. It's time for Wisconsin Life. We're asking you, are you a morning person? Why or why not? Is it by choice, necessity, biology? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Some of us love the early morning, while others loathe the sound of the alarm and love the nightlife. Commentator Wendy Lutzky tells us what's so great for her about getting up at dawn.
Morning has an allure for me that no other time of day can match. For several years, necessity pulled me out under the fading moon to welcome the start of my busy day. The funny thing is, now I find myself looking forward to chasing morning. I crave sunrise so much during summer that 4:30 often glows on my digital clock long after my head rises from the pillow to get a first look at the time. How will I chase morning today? Will it be in the company of the fox who plays hide-and-seek in the roadside grass? Will I pedal my bike to Silver Creek Park to witness the fiery, blood-orange orb of sun change with each passing moment over Lake Michigan? Or maybe that doe and I will surprise each other again as our paths intersect. We were both so startled that she took the highest leap I've ever seen over the ravine rail, while I came to an abrupt stop on the descent of a hill, my toes jamming painfully into the front of my running shoes. Or if the weather doesn't welcome me outside, perhaps I'll join my fellow lap swimmers at the pool and greet the morning through swim goggles. Chasing morning offers me an intimate view of the waking world. It's exhilarating, no matter where I am in the world. Along a misty river in Ireland, with shopkeepers opening for early commuters in Bavaria, dodging in and out of taxis and delivery vans in New York City, and in step with curious calves at the dairy farm near my folks' place in mid-Michigan. When I've shared my travel journals with others who've been on the same trip as me, more than one person has commented that they wish they had gotten up early too. I'm energized by the value these unique mornings away from home add to the bank of my life's memories. But I don't own them. Mornings in northeastern Wisconsin are all mine. And whatever the season, I'm ready. I selfishly hoard the scent of lilacs and the sound of the creek singing its song over the rocks just for me. I imagine the rooster down the road cheering me on as my bike tires spin by in a blur. I welcome the crackling crunch of leaves in their earthy musk. The sun and I meet less frequently as the hours of light diminish, but that makes me all the happier to greet it again the nearer we get to summer solstice. Winter's sharp, cold air turns my nose into a popsicle. It makes me glad I dug through the box of mittens to find the right pair for a particularly brisk morning. By then, the fox is snuggled away, and the deer bedded down in the woods. But I know they'll help me chase morning again sometime soon. Where else but here, in my own Wisconsin neighborhood, can I look forward to the unpredictable? Every day is new. Morning will always come, and hopefully I will be here to chase it for many more years. I can't wait to see what else my corner of Wisconsin has in store for me.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Catch more Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television Monday nights at 8:30 p.m. You can find more information at wisconsinlife.org.
Now we want to hear from you. Are you a morning person by choice or necessity? What kind of unique things do you experience in your neighborhood by getting up early? The morning drive to work, the morning coffee on the porch. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or if you can't stand to be up before the crack of 9, let us know about that and why that is. 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we take our first caller at 800-642-1234, Nancy from Maquonago. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Are you a morning person?
Absolutely. I naturally get up every morning, no matter what, at 3:30.
Wow.
Now that's really a morning person. How did you ever start getting up at 3:30 in the morning?
It started off probably back in 07. And I would get up and work out, and actually started before that. So, yeah, I naturally now get up at 3:30 every morning.
And what do you like about being up so early?
I probably get 90% of my chores or whatever you want to call it, a run in or whatever before probably 10 o'clock in the morning.
Wow. All right. Well, thank you, Nancy. That's why I'm not getting things done. I'm sleeping past 3:30.
It's productivity. Yeah. What was the old Army slogan? We do more things before 9 in the morning than you do, most people do all day or something. That's Nancy's motto, too, I guess. How about you? Are you a morning person or not? What do you love about the morning or hate about it? Or do you experience 4 a.m. from the other side? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Kat joins us now in Palmyra. Hi there, Kat.
Hi, and it's Pat, P-A-T.
Oh, Pat, I'm sorry.
My favorite time of the day is the morning, and my enjoyable time is what's called the gloaming, and that is before dawn. It is when night turns to day, and it's an actual feeling that you get. I sit outside, and it's before the birds even start flying, but it's definitely a time of day when night turns to day, and then just after that, dawn appears.
Well, what is it you like so much about that particular moment, the night turning to day, Pat?
It's just an awakening. It's an awakening. It gives you a good feeling that the earth is in tune, and just the thought of the new day starting.
Pat, that's beautiful. Thank you so much for that call. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a morning person? Are you not? What do you love about the early morning hours, or why do you like to avoid them whenever possible? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Like Joseph did, who says, without a doubt, I feel infinitely better throughout the day when I rise early, healthier, higher energy level, and more alert. The trick is actually getting up.
Yeah, that is, well, you and I, Veronica, have both worked at various times in the early morning show here on the Ideas Network. It took me some training. I had to, when I first got the job with the Tom Clark Show, I started playing The Sims, the computer game. Before I started, I'd get up a little earlier, reward myself by playing a computer game until I had myself trained to be up by 4:30 in the morning, I guess, to walk into to the studio here.
And I had a family member call me every morning my first 3 months to make sure I was up, which was dedication. Yeah,
and that I trained myself to be up right away with the alarm. And now when TV shows or radio commercials use that alarm sound, I have this panicky moment like I've been dreaming and it's time to wake up and go to work at 4:30.
Oh, well, let's see what Debbie has to say. Debbie is in Clayton. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. How are you guys this afternoon?
Real good.
Good, thanks.
Well, I'm definitely a morning person. We get up at our home about 4:45 a.m. each day to get ready and going for the day, go to work. And I especially love the morning during the summer months when we have daylight at 4:30 a.m. That is definitely when I'm ready to hop out of bed.
What do you do in the winter, though? Do you still get up early even though there's still hours of darkness left?
Yeah, we do get up early. I must admit, I'm probably not as ambitious in the winter months. You know, sometimes I do get going a few days a week and go out and go to a 5:20 a.m. exercise class. So that keeps me going.
Great, Debbie. Thanks so much, and enjoy the Joy Cardine Show on your way home.
And another quick call here from Irma in Appleton. Hi, Irma.
Hello.
Are you morning or a night person?
I'm definitely night person. I love the night. It's peaceful. No one's around. And I really enjoy the night. The morning, I'm dysfunctional. Actually, I'm very slow in the morning. So.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that. I think I fall more in the Irma camp, I have to say. I love the night.
I can't tell anymore. I was a night person much of my life. I trained myself to get up in the morning, and I don't, you know, absent, you know, kids getting up in the morning, getting ready for school, getting up for work, I don't know what would happen. It would be a dangerous scientific experiment, I think.
Oh, interesting. Well, lots to love about both the options, whether or not you can actually make it happen, I guess.
Yeah, thanks for all your calls. More comments on the Central Time Facebook page, and you can share yours. Keep the conversation going over on Facebook.